Thank you. And there you go. All right. Well, thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here, even though it took a blizzard. God put a blizzard in my way, but we overcame, and especially because of my friend Kirk there, who was the organizer and the man who's been planning this for about a year. And so I'm grateful to be here. It's nice not to have to wear the heavy winter coat that I brought with me. Didn't bring an umbrella, but and I'm sorry if I dragged the storm in this direction from Colorado. Now, I have to be honest with you. You heard that I was announced as a photographer, and normally my presentations are in a dark room with a bunch of photographs, because that's what I'm really good at. And so this is a little different for me, and so I'm not going to be able to show you things. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to share the story of what a nice Jewish boy like me is doing involved with probably the most important relic of Christianity. And at the end of this, don't let me forget, and I'll explain to you, I'll give you the answer to that question when I'm finished. So typically, the first question I always get is, well, how did you get involved with the Shroud? So I'm going to tell you, rather than waiting till the end. I am a professional photographer. I had a photographic studio in Santa Barbara, California for many years. I was sort of well known as the guy who could do the impossible. In other words, they would take a project to my competitors, and when the competitor said, nah, we can't do that, then they would bring it to me and I would do it. So I was contacted by an organization, a company, that was actually a contractor to Los Alamos National Laboratories. You know who they are. Famous for the atomic bomb. And they needed a photographic consultant. In those days, if you needed something recorded off of a screen, like a monitor or a green screen raster display like an oscilloscope, you had to set up a camera, you had to block off all the light. We had these hoods that we would put up to block the light. You would have to get the exposure correctly. You'd have to use certain filtration and stuff. Now we hit the print screen button and it comes spitting out of our printer. Things have changed a bit over the years. But in those days, that was the project. They were taking these old, unclassified motion pictures of above-ground atomic explosions. And because, remember, in those days, computers were pretty rare, too. This was 1975, 76. But the folks at Los Alamos had a big, monstrous computer called a Cray that was water-cooled, which tells you how old that is. And at that point in time, they were able to get new information from these old unclassified motion pictures. So at this stage of the lecture, I would always say, look, I could tell you more, but it was classified. If I tell you more, I have to kill you. So what I think I'll do is we'll leave it at that. I worked on this project for 7 months. At the end of 7 months, finished, moved on. And the guy I'd worked with, a guy named Don Devan, about a month later, called me up again and he said, Barry, what do you know about the Shroud of Turin? And I laughed. I said, but Don, I'm Jewish. And Don laughed. He said, so am I, remember? Because Don was one of the other Jewish guys on our team. And so I said, well, I don't know much about it. I said, it's probably just another one of those relics that, you know, there was a whole industry of making relics in medieval times, and they were churning out, somebody said there's enough pieces of the true cross to build a building, and so I don't know about those things. What I do know is this, that I wasn't very interested. I was a total skeptic, and obviously I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home, even though I did just have a pork sandwich, by the way. So, you know, I was raised, the way I describe my childhood, because both my parents were born in Poland, my grandparents lived with us, so I was first generation, and I always tell people, you know, fiddler on the roof, pretty much that's what my upbringing was. So I was not very comfortable, but I also had no emotional attachment to Jesus, because, you know, I was not raised in a Christian home where anybody raised as a Christian, almost anybody I would assume, would have some emotional connection with Jesus, of course. I didn't know much about, all I knew about Jesus actually was he was Jewish. And that was about the extent of my knowledge of Jesus. So I wasn't very comfortable. And he said, look, Barry, and of course, this man was an imaging guy, this guy Don, who I'd worked with. And so he started explaining that a couple of scientists over at Sandia Laboratories, which is the sister laboratory to Los Alamos, right there in Albuquerque, I guess. And he said these guys had an instrument there called a VP8 image analyzer, and it was basically you input stuff with a black and white video camera, it displayed it on a green screen. There was a box that looked like an old tuner or amplifier. See, in this crowd, you know what I'm talking about. When I say that to a young audience, they don't have a clue what I'm talking about. So that's a welcome change, actually. So, you know, what they discovered when they put a shroud image in there, this machine, excuse me, basically took an image with a black and white video camera and stretched it vertically. It was one of the capabilities. You could tweak it with different knobs. And one of the things it did was it took the image density and stretched it into vertical relief. So you could do that with any image and you would get something. Well, they put a shroud photograph into this and they get the natural relief of a human form. And when he explained that to me, I said, but Don, that's impossible. And he said, well, that's what they got. And because of that, and because of this unique property that photographs and artworks don't have, they decided to put together a team of researchers that could go and investigate this piece of cloth and try and figure out how the image was formed. And I said, well, you know, and I'm still a little hesitant. I'm thinking, gee, this is a very Christian deal. Why am I here? But the image properties sort of hooked me. You know, I thought, how is it possible to get an image made that way? On a piece of cloth especially. So I wasn't very comfortable, but I said, okay, I'm going to join this team. So I get on the team, and about, I guess, 2 or 3 months into the project, and I was in California at the time, and our team was working in different groups, regions around the country. There was a New Mexico group, a Colorado group, a California group, and a group in the East Coast where all the medical and forensic medical guys were, blood guys. And I was in the California group, and a couple of new guys joined our team from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And one of these guys, a guy named Don Lynn, may he rest in peace, Don Lynn was the imaging project manager on Voyager and Viking and Mariner and Galileo. You might have heard of them. And I was impressed. I mean, I was like a little kid with his hero. This is a NASA imaging scientist, not just anyone, but the guy who was in charge of the imaging on some of these really important projects. And he was a good Catholic guy, and I remember saying to him one day, gee, Don, what's a nice Jewish boy like me doing on this team? And he looked at me and he said, apparently you've forgotten that the man in question is a Jew. And I said, no, that's about all I know about Jesus, but I know he's a Jew. And he said, oh, so you don't think God wants one of his chosen people on our team? And then I laughed. I said, no, I never thought that. And he said, listen, Barry, let me give you a piece of advice. God doesn't tell us in advance what the plan is. Go to Turin, do the very best job you can, and one day you'll know why. And on those words, I stayed on that team. Now, in retrospect, looking back at it now all these 35 years later, I realize now that was God speaking to me through his lips. Now, I was too young, immature, and egotistical and arrogant for God to reveal what the plan was, and it took another 18 years before I reached that point where God did reveal it to me. But I did join the team, and I did go to Turin. And I did examine that cloth and held it in my very hands. My Catholic friends tell me that makes me a relic too. And perhaps I am. As I examined the cloth, I have to tell you that conventional wisdom in those days was, well, this is probably some kind of an artwork, painting, something like that. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I'm a photographer. I always carry a 10-power magnifier with me wherever I go, except here because it's in my Swiss Army knife, which I had to leave home. or give it to the TSA would have been the alternative. So I left it home. But I looked at this thing, and immediately, of course, I'm looking for paint, pigment, and brush strokes, and I stupidly opened my big mouth publicly at that moment in my life and said, "Oh, give me 5 minutes, we'll find the paint, and we'll go home." Oh boy, did I live to regret those words. And it's a little longer than 5 minutes later, it's 35 years later, and here I still am, and now this is all I do, by the way. We have a nonprofit, and I run the nonprofit. You know, I retired 3 years ago, and I was self-employed for 42 years, so, you know, I worked 8 to 10 hours a day, that was normal. Now that I'm retired and running a nonprofit, it's 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. But it's the most satisfying and rewarding work that I've done in my whole life, and it gives me the opportunity to do this, to come here, to be with other people, to share this story with you. So we examine this piece of cloth, and I have to say, within the first 15 or 20 minutes that it was laid in front of us, I knew it wasn't a painting. Now, I didn't know that scientifically, the way our evidence ultimately did prove. But at that moment in time, look, we've all seen paintings and artworks. They have a distinctive way, you know, when an artist creates something, you know, they outline it and they fill in the spaces. And the shroud image is just the opposite. It has no distinct borders, it just fades out. And now that's unique, because artworks don't do that. So I understood real quickly, okay, so it's not a painting. Okay, and ultimately the chemistry and the physics, the spectral data, the ultraviolet fluorescence photography, the X-ray fluorescence, the spectral data especially. We had with us a big fat binder with the spectral data for every paint and pigment known to man from medieval to modern times. It was one of the chemists on our team, may he rest in peace, Ray Rogers, brilliant chemist of Los Alamos National Labs. And our team spent 19 months preparing before we ever went to Turin to examine this piece of cloth. And so we were looking for paint. That was one of the conventional wisdom things that, oh yeah, this has got to be a painting. You know, I can stand here right now and tell you that even though you've heard the opposite on radio and TV, you know, and I've been in about 20 documentaries on every network, take my word for it, that's not the place to get information about the shroud. Networks have a tendency to want to be controversial, so they'll start a great, you know, program, and they go for 40 minutes, even in balance. One guy says yes, the other guy says no, and then the last 20 minutes, blatant attack on Christianity. Blatant attack on Christianity. Now, I'm a Jew, I can say that. If you say that, they're going to go, well, of course you feel that way, you're a Christian. But I've seen it with my own eyes, and I've participated in these programs for years, and they do that, and that's the way it works, because why? Television is entertainment, not science. And when people write me and say, well, I heard in a documentary such and such, I always say, get better sources. That's not a good source of information. So we examine this piece of cloth, we finish the project, we come back, we spend the next 2.5-3 years reducing the data, collecting it all, evaluating it, putting it into scientific papers, and all of our data is published in about 25 to 30 articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals. And when I say peer review, in today's world with the internet and stuff, peer review has sort of been watered down. There are journals now, there's one Nigerian journal that a number of shroud people and modern day shroud people always publish their work in, and the only review they do is to make sure your check is good before they publish your stuff. They're not really scientific journals at all. They're just vanity publications. Well, our team was just the opposite. The journals we submitted our work to were the highest, high-quality journals of their day, and many of them still are to this day. And nowadays, as I said, you know, there's so much nonsense about the shroud out there. But at any rate, I finished the project. I'm still not 100% convinced. There were a few things about the shroud that nobody answered the question I had. You know, one of the ironic things about this image on the cloth, it has bloodstains. The blood's still red. That was a deal breaker. That was a deal breaker for me right at the time. I said, you know what? I'm no forensic pathologist, but old blood turns black or brown, and it usually does so in 24 to 48 hours at the outside the most. If this thing's 2,000 years old, why is the blood still red? And it would take until 1995 before I would get an answer to that question. Now, through that period of time, of course, much of the other evidence began to convince me, and I was sort of stuck with this very last piece of information in 1995, and I said, wait a minute. I need to figure out why this blood is red. Now, one of the guys on our team was a guy named Dr. Alan Adler. He was a world-renowned blood chemist, also Jewish. And I was on the phone with Al one day, and he was saying, you know, that he, as a Jew, had also come to pretty much believe the shroud was a real thing. It's forensically perfect, by the way. Forensically perfect. No way that an artist put those bloodstains on there. They came onto that cloth by contact with a body, period. It's the only way they could have gotten there. And I remember saying to Al, I said, well, you know, I'm still not convinced. He said, well, what's holding you back? Now, he's a blood expert. Somebody said to me, why the heck didn't you ask him this question 18 years earlier? And I said to him, Al, why is the blood still red? And he said, Barry, he said, you know what they did to this man? They started beating him up the night before in the Garden of Gethsemane. They never gave him any water. So by the next morning, he was already in hypovolemic shock. He was, and then they started really working on him. They beat him with the, they scourged him. There are 120 or so scourge marks all over the body. They put this crown or cap of thorns. By the way, it wasn't a pretty little crown the way we see it in the artwork. Can you imagine telling a Roman soldier, yeah, you're going to execute this guy, but before you do, weave him a pretty crown out of thorns. Of course not. They took a thorn bush and they smashed it on his head, and on the shroud, the bloodstains cover his head. His entire scalp is severely wounded. Anyway, they beat him, they scourge him, they crucify him. Well, what happens when you go into shock? The liver starts making a chemical called bilirubin, and it starts flooding your bloodstream with bilirubin. And Adler, the blood chemist, had found a high content of bilirubin when he did the blood chemistry on the shroud blood. And so he said to me, Barry, blood that's that high content of bilirubin stays red forever. That was it. And I had to believe him, he was Jewish. I was just testing to see if you're awake. At any rate, so suddenly in 1995, all these years later, I find myself coming to accept that this has to be the real thing. Now, I was almost there anyway, but that was it. That was the thing that put me over the threshold. And I thought, you know, one of the things that I had watched in those years from the 80s through the 90s was how much misinformation about this piece of cloth was in the press, in the media, on television, or wherever else. And I was offended by that because I felt an obligation. And here's why. There had to be a billion or so people on this planet who had more right to be in that room than I did. And yet God saw fit, for whatever reason, at that moment in my life, to put me on that team and force me to stay there against my own will. And I felt afterwards that brought with it an obligation. And it occurred to me around that period of my life in the mid-90s that I hadn't been put in that room for me. I'd been put in that room for you. I was a witness. And so at that point in time, I got this wild idea. I'll build a website. And so I built shroud.com. Now somebody said to me, how did you get that name? It was available. We are the first website on the Shroud. We're the oldest. We're the largest. We just had our 17th anniversary on January 21st of this year. And it became my mission, which I, by the way, all this in my spare time, because I still ran my business through all those years. And it was my responsibility, I felt, to bring this information without any spin, without any emotion, to give you, people to whom this really matters on a much more personal level than it did to me at that time, to make this information available. And as it says on the front page of the website, given the facts, you have to make up your own mind about this. So we don't try and convince anybody. I had a guy come up to me after a lecture in Vancouver, British Columbia. And he said, "You know, Mr. Schwartz," he says, "that was a great lecture, but you'll never convince me." And I looked him right in the eye and said, "Sir, what makes you think I even care what you believe?" He took two steps back like I had hit him. And I said, "Sir, that's between you and God. Take it up with Him." And so what I've come to understand is it's not my job to convince people of anything. It's not my job to talk about theology. I speak across all denominations. I teach a course to future priests at the Pontifical Seminary. Imagine that, a Jew teaching future priests about the shroud. It's pretty cool. I'll be doing that in a couple. I'll be there in about a week and a half. I'll be doing it again this year. And so from my point of view, I came to understand that my job was simply to take the information that I've been so privileged to obtain firsthand and in person, and to share it with people in an honest, straightforward way without pushing in any direction. And it's not my place to tell people what to believe or how to believe. My personal feeling on the matter, there's 6 billion people on this planet, probably 6 billion different paths to God. Each of us has to find our own. Now, the real problem was, from my own point of view, I hadn't really thought about God for very much of my life. At age 13, I walked away from Judaism. I was offended. I saw what I thought was hypocrisy, and I didn't want to be a part of it. Frankly, I'm not a big fan of institutions of any kind, particularly those that are religious institutions, and I'm being inclusive of all of them. I'm not excluding anybody, including my own. So in 1996, when I built Shroud.com and I started to go out and lecture, what happens? I start getting all these new questions. "Well, what do you believe?" And they were no longer talking about the Shroud. They were talking about my own faith. Well, here I am, age 50 at that moment. I hadn't thought about God since I was 13. And so I'm suddenly confronted with this necessity of figuring out what I believe, because my goal from the beginning here is just to be honest and tell the truth. And that means there's no question that's too personal. If I'm going to stand up in the world and publicly talk about this controversial subject of the Shroud of Turin, there can be no questions that are off limits. So now I have to find an answer to these questions that people are asking me. "Well, what do you believe?" I had no clue. Well, I already told you my background, fiddler on the roof. And so God was part of everything every day in our home. I mean, my grandfather got up in the morning and did morning prayers. On Friday, they lit the candles, you know. We had two separate sets of dishes and two separate sets of silverware. You know, it was following the Jewish Orthodox tradition. Not ultra-Orthodox, but Orthodox. So I sort of have this confrontation with myself. What do I believe? And so I had to honestly and openly look in my heart. And lo and behold, there was God waiting patiently all those years. All I had to do was acknowledge Him. And I did. Because suddenly I find myself in this unique position of being a Jew whose faith in God was restored by the Shroud of Turin. Now, how many people can say that? There were three of us on the team. Two of them are dead, so I'm the only one left that can say that, sadly. And so basically that's sort of what brought me to where I am today. For 17 years, the website has grown. It has always reported the honest, fair, and unbiased information. That means sometimes you'll find in the pro-Shroud world two people who are both pro the authenticity, completely in disagreement as to how the image was formed or some facet of the Shroud. And we'll publish the points of view of both. The goal being to give you the best information that there is, and you have to decide it, just like I had to figure it out for myself. You have to do the same. Each of us has to find God in our own way, in our own hearts. And so for me, the irony of getting up on stages like this and talking about the shroud, and now, more often than not, talking about my own faith, this is something that if somebody had told me this even 20 years ago, I would have bet my life you'd be wrong. Never bet against God. Can't win. Okay, so at the beginning of my little talk here today, I said that before I'm finished, I'm going to explain to you what a nice Jewish boy like me is doing involved with the shroud. And it took me all those years, but I finally figured it out. Isn't it funny how God always picks a Jew to be the messenger? I'm the messenger. That's my job. And all I have to do is tell the truth, which is great, because if God had said, go out there and make up any story you can to convince people the shroud's authentic, I would have failed miserably. You know, I learned the truth at age 5 at the end of a leather belt. I told you, my family was from the old country. My mother wielded she's just a little lady, 4'11". Just turned 90, by the way, 2 weeks ago. And she was from the old country, and boy, they didn't mess around. Now, she was nice. She only used a leather belt when she was a young girl. Her parents, my grandparents, used a rug beater made of wire. So, you know, I'll take the belt. And so, at age 5, I cut my bangs at a friend's house, and I went home, and my mother said, what happened to your hair? And I lied. I said, I don't know. You know, a big V cut in my hair. I don't know. She said, tell me the truth. I don't know. Out came the belt. Eventually, I was able to tell her the truth. But it was a painful lesson that I've never forgotten. And I think that was the beginning of the path. That's when God interceded and said, look, this man in the future is going to have to go out there and he's going to have to be brutally honest. He's going to have to share his most personal feelings with the rest of the world. And so the truth is critical for this young lad to learn. And I learned it. Of course, if something like that happened today, you know what would happen? Somebody would call the cops. And, child abuse. Well, you know, I disagree. I'm glad I was given that lesson all those years ago. It truly was a lesson. Now, if my mother had just told me to tell the truth, you know, when you're 5 years old, what do you know? You don't listen. But I'll never forget. To this day, I remember that moment. And so, to me, I believe that I've been on this path for a lot longer than I ever realized. Just as one example, before I ever heard of the Shroud of Turin, I was living in Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara's famous. It's got one of the missions that Father Junipero Serra founded along the California. You might have heard of those. San Juan Capistrano and all of those. And Santa Barbara is called the Queen of the Missions. And a friend of mine, a guy I was in the Navy with, his brother was a musical prodigy, and he was the musical director at the old mission in Santa Barbara. And he knew that I played folk guitar. And he called me up one day and said, hey, why don't you try out and be on this folk thing? We're going to do a folk mass at the old mission. And I said, what do you think I said? But I'm Jewish. Of course. And he said, that's okay. We'll pay you $10 to show up. How do you get a Jew to go to Catholic mass every Sunday? You pay him $10. I was able to quit my liquor store job on the $10. Well, actually, figure out four masses a month, $10, $40 a month. That was enough for me to quit working in a liquor store. So, I mean, I was married and we needed the money, you know. But think about this. Now, obviously, I do spend a good bit of time with Catholics, obviously. And think about this. For 3.5 years, my track record for attendance at mass was better than all of my Catholic friends. One mass. I missed one mass in 3.5 years. I don't have any Catholic friends from that time and that era who could even come close to my record. But what I'm really getting at is this was God educating me. I didn't know anything about Christianity still. And, of course, Catholicism is only one part of Christianity. I understand that. But the Mass is an integral part of the Catholic Church and, you know, Episcopals and others as well. And so here I am intimate with the Mass because we were playing every part of the Mass. And this was before I'd even heard of the Shroud. So I see all these events as little clues that God was training me to do this that I do now. And so for me, imagine figuring all this out all those years later. What a shock this came to be. And at the same time, what a gift. I mean, I feel my name in Hebrew is Baruch. And for those of you that might speak Hebrew, that means blessed. And guess what? Even my name was appropriate because I feel blessed to have been given this work to do. And to be able to travel around the world, lecturing to groups like this and teaching future priests. If somebody had told me that, even 5 years before it took place, I would have just laughed in their face. Now I don't laugh at any of these things anymore. Now I take it very seriously. I have a friend who's a stand-up comedian in Los Angeles. And he always wants to make silly jokes about Jesus, about God, whatever. And I always tell him, Joey, don't make jokes about this. This is serious. And maybe you don't understand that. And maybe I didn't understand that, but I'm the guy standing here looking into your faces, and I know you understand that. So my respect is for you. My mission is for you. I was in that room not for me, but for you. And it took all those years to find out. So here I am, the messenger, and I hope that you enjoyed the message. Thank you very much. Okay. Here's a question. How am I doing on time? How much time do we have? 8 minutes. Okay. There was a gentleman before when we first arrived who asked a question. Where is that gentleman? There he is. Could everybody hear? Repeat it? Okay. With all the TV documentaries, with all these experts who speak publicly on the Shroud, how can so many experts in so many different disciplines come up with so many different answers to the same single question? Is that a good paraphrase? Okay. Well, I guess it depends on who you call an expert. Because there's a guy who gets up on national television, his name's Joe Nickel, he wears a white lab coat and calls himself a senior research fellow. Yet he's not connected with any academic or scientific institution. He's a member of PSYCOP, an atheist-based anti-everything group. And, you know, they publish a magazine, and they're the Skeptical Inquirer, it's called. And they're professional skeptics. So he's not really a scientist, he just plays one on TV. And the problem with it is this. These people have never studied the Shroud. They took a position long ago about the Shroud, and now they stick to their guns. And I have to say that this guy, Joe Nickel, is quite experienced of standing on the stage because he's formerly a stage magician. And then his sidekick is a guy named The Amazing Randy. You might have seen him. I'm always suspect when somebody puts amazing in their name. Maybe The Amazing Spider-Man I can buy, you know. But The Amazing Randy, and these are the people who call themselves experts, who've never seen the Shroud, who have never looked at it under a microscope, who have never studied the chemistry. And I debated Joe Nickel on the radio one time, and Joe has a very standardized technique, and I've seen him do it enough times that I know how to play right into that. He starts by throwing a few bits and pieces of early Shroud lore that have been proven false. But he throws these things out at you. Oh, what about this guy? Walter McCrone said this, and there was this memorandum back from the Archbishop, and all of this has been proven false, okay? So he starts there. Then guys like me who know the science throw the science back at him, and of course that overwhelms him very quickly. So he waves his hands and he goes, ah, that's just the rantings of believers. But he can't say that to me. Because by his definition, I'm not a believer. Not the way he meant. He meant Christian, of course. And so the beauty is this. Joe once said to me, you know, the shroud's just too perfect. It can't be real. So I said, so Joe, if it were less perfect, then you'd accept it's authentic. And he said, of course not. So I've learned that once people have made up their minds, that's it. They've made up their minds. Leave them alone. Don't worry about it. I'm not worried about the skeptics. But to answer your question, look, the real science that our team did is published in peer-reviewed, highly respected scientific journals. Not in magazines, not in books, not on websites, not on blogs. Peer-reviewed scientific journals of the highest caliber. That's where the evidence lives. And unless somebody's quoting the real science, they can call themselves anything they want, but they're far from being experts. And I think that's the answer to your question. Yes?
Were you allowed to touch the clock?
Yes, that's why I became a relic. In the Catholic faith, if you physically come in contact with an avowed relic, that becomes a second-class relic. So the shroud would be, I guess, a first-class relic. Anybody know that? No? Okay, well, listen. I'll tell you what I know. That if you touch it, a relic, or if you touch the relic against something else, it too becomes a relic, a second-class relic or a third-class. So I'm not sure what class of relic I am, but I'm starting to feel pretty second-class, so. Yes, sir. Ah! Did you hear? There's a difference between science and setting out to validate your personal agenda. That's correct, and that's a great thing that you brought up, because one of the things that amazed me about the Shroud of Turin Research Project, the team that we were a part of, they had no agenda except for one thing, do the best science possible and bring the truth out. And people say, oh yeah, we were a bunch of Christians. Well, not exactly. There were three Jews, one Mormon, a couple of Catholics, one evangelical, and the rest I don't know, but these were scientists who worked in the nuclear weapons industry, so I'm assuming there were probably a few atheists and agnostics in the group as well. And somebody chastised me for not publishing on the website with the list of names the religious affiliations of these men. And I said, listen, I don't know the religious affiliations of these men. If that had been a criteria for membership on the team, most of those men wouldn't have been involved. A few might have. Most of them would not have been involved. These were hardcore scientists, and people forget. Los Alamos, Sandia, Air Force Weapons Laboratory, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. These are the best scientists that America had in their arsenal of scientists at that moment in history. These were not a bunch of guys going out to prove or disprove, is it Jesus, is it real, does it prove the resurrection, all of those things. These men were going there to figure out how the image was formed. And how successful were we? We failed miserably. We came back able to tell you what it's not. Not a painting. Proved it's not a painting. And I don't use the word prove very easily. Proved it's not a painting. Proved it's not a scorch. Joe Nickel, that skeptic I told you about. So they had a metal statue, heated it up, and they scorched the image onto the cloth. Well, without getting too technical, scorched linen will fluoresce under UV fluorescence photography. We photographed the entire shroud with UV fluorescence, and you know, there are all these burns on the shroud from a fire in 1532, and every scorch fluoresced exactly as it should. And instead, the image not only did not fluoresce, it quenched the background fluorescence. It's not a scorch, so we proved that. And not a photograph. Somebody said, Leonardo da Vinci did it. Never mind that the shroud's documented in the historic record 100 years before Leonardo was born. He was a good artist, but he wasn't that good. And to make a light-sensitive emulsion on a piece of cloth, you have to coat it with some kind of a silver salt. We did pyrolysis mass spectrometry all over that cloth. We didn't find one molecule of silver. Cannot be a photograph. So we proved what it's not, but we could not tell you a single mechanism that could create an image with the same chemical and physical properties as the image on the Shroud of Turin. Why am I convinced? I'm convinced because the science convinced me, and I was privileged to be a part of it. And so now my role is simply to explain that to people who are doubtful and skeptical because the media bombards you with nonsense about the shroud. And it breaks my heart because even though it never had the same emotional attachment, I never had the same emotional attachment that you might have because this is Jesus, don't forget he was one of our guys. So, putting aside denominations and religion for a minute, look at what this man suffered. As a human being, how can you not be empathetic to his suffering, which is so beautifully documented, beautifully in not a classical sense, but so well documented on this cloth? How can you not, as a human being, not feel empathy for what this man endured, for what he believed in? I knew somebody was going to go there. The shroud has been in Turin, Italy, northern Italy, since 1578. In 1978, they were celebrating the 400th anniversary of it being in Turin, which is why they publicly displayed it and allowed us, after the public exhibit, to go and do our research. So that's where it's been. As far as the age of the shroud, yes, in 1988, they did a radiocarbon dating of the shroud. That radiocarbon dating claimed, the result was claimed that the cloth was medieval in origin. Now, a good 20 minutes of my normal lecture deals with the shroud. So, Kirk, you were holding up the little brochure there a moment ago. I don't know the schedule, but to give you the in-depth answer to the radiocarbon dating business, you need to come and see. And he's holding up one of the brochures. Are there some of those brochures around that these folks can see? You're pointing. You know, if you can come to one of the other lectures I'm going to be doing, the whole last 20 minutes of my full lecture with slides explains that, and it does it in a manner that makes it very clear and would be impossible for me to try and explain it briefly, but I will give you a simple, fast answer. We have proven, and I don't use that word lightly, we have proven that the sample chosen to radiocarbon date the shroud in 1988 was anomalous, did not represent the rest of the cloth. It was only one tiny piece taken from one corner, and that corner had been, at some point in its history, repaired with new material woven in during medieval time. And that's what they dated, getting a date in the between 1260 and 1320 or something like that. But tonight I will show you, or tonight or whenever I do these lectures, because I don't have the schedule memorized, I will show you the evidence that proves this. And when I say prove, remember that the radiocarbon dating paper that said the shroud was medieval was published in Nature, a highly regarded peer-reviewed journal, which just shows you that highly regarded peer-reviewed journals ain't perfect. Okay? There are now two other articles also in highly regarded peer-reviewed journals that show that that data was incorrect. So the shroud is, look, there's plenty of evidence that shows it's older than the earliest date they gave. And if you come to one of those lectures, I promise you by the time that lecture's over, you're going to understand in detail why the radiocarbon dating should be set aside that was done in 1988. It's not valid. The sample was anomalous. It didn't represent the main body of the cloth.
Didn't they recently release the Shroud of Turin in the last week or so for a review or something like that?
Yeah. A friend of mine, Giulio Fanti, wrote a book. He used some other techniques. He used two pretty much commonly used, well-accepted FTIR. It's called Fourier Transform Infrared. And another one escapes my memory. And he did a dating using two techniques that have never before been used for dating. And he wrote it into a book in Italian, and they published the book, and it came out right around Easter time. How convenient. Yeah, now, here's the thing. They showed it on television. The last thing Pope Benedict did on his last day as Pope authorized a television exposition, which happened a week ago Saturday. It's always off display and sealed up in its case, which again, if you come to the longer lecture, I'll show you pictures of all that. But Benedict was kind enough to do that. And if you want to still see the exhibition, if you go to shroud.com and it tells you right on the front page, click the link and it takes you to a place where you can You can watch a 9.5-minute version, or you can watch the whole 90 minutes if you so desire, that are now linked up on YouTube. So the end result of all this is that, you know, the sadness is the media catches and picks up things that are typically attacks on the shroud. When the scientific paper came out proving the radiocarbon dating results of 1988 were incorrect, you didn't hear about that, did you? No. Because you know what? Attacks on Christianity apparently sell more newspapers than proof that perhaps the Shroud of Turin's authentic. Okay? That's the sadness of it. And look, I've been part of the media for most of my career too. And I didn't used to believe there was any kind of anti-Christian bias. But there is. And of course, you've known that for a long time. It took me a while to discover it. Could everybody hear? Yeah, I'll repeat. In our work, did we find a way to duplicate what's on the shroud? And the answer is, yeah, we tried everything and nothing came close. And since then, skeptics out there, including one guy in 2010 using my photographs, he wrote to me, said, oh, I'm a researcher on the shroud. And I sent him the highest resolution, best quality images I made in 1978. His name was Luigi Garlicelli. And Luigi Garlicelli then came out with a book, no peer-reviewed science, just a book. But first he came out with a press release saying that he'd proven the shroud was a fake, and the way he did it was he duplicated it. So, if you go to shroud.com, you'll find an article by a French physician who worked with Garlicelli, went over to Garlicelli, and they worked together. My friend's name is Thibaut Heimberger, and Thibaut, who's a brilliant researcher in his own right, put the results by Garlicelli to the test, and he didn't even come into the ballpark. He didn't match one property. It's easy to make something that looks like the shroud because it's very well documented, and my photographs are all over the place, not just mine, but others that have been taken since. But to make something that matches the same chemical and physical properties, nobody's ever even come close. And because I have a high profile and they know I'm an imaging guy and a photographer, people send me stuff all the time from all over this planet. Look what we found on the shroud. And people find all kind of stuff on the shroud. So bottom line is this. When I'm showing my images in one of my regular presentations and that kind of subject comes up, and they ask, but what about the flowers, and what about coins, and what about spear tips, and all these things that people have claimed to find on the shroud? I always turn to the image and I say, do you see the image of the man? And they go, well, yeah. I say, isn't that what this is about? It's not about spear tips and flowers and coins. And there's all this diversion. But the real answer is, there it is. Now, last thing I'm going to say, because I know I'm out of time. What does it mean, this piece of cloth? Well, the answer is never going to be on a piece of cloth. A piece of cloth is not the key to faith. Now, this piece of cloth might make you think about it. And if that does, and you think about it, and you open your heart the way I did, well, then sure, it might lead you to your faith. But the answer is not on the shroud. It did not come with the book of instructions. The answer is in the eye and the heart of those who look upon it. Thank you.